tell us how the show came to be and if you were given any guidelines about, well, what to do or what not to do?
Well, the show really originated in a suggestion by Janet Carden of the ICA to do a piece on Philadelphia for the Century 4 celebration. And she was very open in what I would do. I had no guidelines of what it would be.
What did you want to learn about the city before figuring out what you would do in your piece?
Well, I have been to Philadelphia on several occasions over the last 15 years, and I've always had trouble finding my way around and getting the layout of the city. So I was a little apprehensive about doing the city specifically. I mean, the textures and geography of the actual city. So I had remembered from an early trip when I was a kid here at 14, the historical points of interest. And so I kind of went to the historical things. And
was the history you remembered like the history we get in Thanksgiving where there's two pilgrims and a pumpkin and an Indian behind?
Yeah. It's a pretty much cliche things, but I was hoping to find some, you know, my own angles on them.
What kinds of tours did you get when you were doing the
piece? Well, I was given an excellent tour by Paula Marincola from the ICA, and she took me and my girlfriend Elizabeth Ross around for intensively. We started about 7 o'clock in the morning, and she let us go about 6 in the evening, and just took us every, we went to the Italian market, and we went to the Independence Hall area, and I took the tour in there. That was interesting. And I got a lot of information on that particular tour. The Parks Department gives a very good tour, you know, and I felt like their information was kind of exact. And generally, you know, we were sort of feeling our way around. And I don't know, I like to keep it open. I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to focus on or what I'm going to use. I really didn't know at all.
How did it come to you? How did it come together?
Very slowly. It came together over about a year and a half of adjusting to concepts that I had that were preconceived and then to the actual information or chance information that I would fall upon.
When you walk in, you walk through the cornucopia, and there's a big ship, maybe the ship of state with George Washington, huge George Washington at the standing on the ship. You have a lot of people who work with you on the piece. How did you describe what you wanted from George Washington to them?
Well, the ship actually was a sort of extension of my original idea was to do a bandwagon like the Grand Ole Circus bandwagons and to incorporate historical figures sort of in to what would be the carving or so forth on the sides. And I liked that idea. I've always wanted to make a big bandwagon, but I felt that this was an opportunity to do a full environment, which is a more complicated spatial sort of arrangement in a room. In other words, decorate a whole room three-dimensionally. And I felt that the bandwagon was too contained an idea. So I think what happened was that the cornucopia could well be a motif on the side of a bandwagon. In fact, I think it was the image that was in my mind. And as I made my first model, I thought that it would be good to take the cornucopia and use it as a big emblem, which would expand and fill up a lot of the space, and also incorporate this kind of staircase in the back of the gallery. And the staircase would be kind of a actual kind of a vehicle where people go up and down, you know, and that up and down level change would be visible through the cornucopia as you looked at the thing. And then the bandwagon itself would be sitting in the cornucopia. But that bandwagon changed into a barge. Because one reason that happened was that Judy Stein told me that William Rush had designed a kind of historical float for, and it was sort of in the shape of, I think they called it a car. So the car kind of turned into a barge. because, in fact, she gave me an account that described a pageant where a lot of the political figures and personalities of the town were actually riding on a sort of 17th century or 18th century galleon. So that's kind of what mine turned into.
In most of your pieces, the subject matter is stuff we're all familiar with. In Ruckus, Manhattan, it's the streets itself and the subways. And in the discount store in Minneapolis, it's the kind of shopping that everybody, the kind of displays everybody knows about. In Philadelphia Cornucopia, it's more historical references in it. But do you think that there are historical figures that everybody is as familiar with as they are with the subway?
Yes, I think so. I was very worried that I was kind of just really going over the same old hackneyed ground, but I must admit I was compelled to do so. I couldn't stop myself. It's really what I wanted to do. It was very exciting to do the big personalities like Jefferson and Washington and Franklin. It was very exciting to attempt a portraiture.
When you're coming in to a city like Philadelphia and are commissioned to do a piece here, do you have to be careful not to insult the city or the residents of the city in any way, since in this instance you're the outsider? It's not like New York, which you've lived in for many years.
Certainly, definitely. I try to use a good taste if I can, but I don't want to. I think that people are, that a little, a few liberties are kind of enjoyed by all. I don't want to make it too canned, that it is, doesn't have any life, you know.
What do you think the liberties are with this piece?
I really wouldn't know. I don't know. I to an extent, you don't really know what will offend people.
Are you ever criticized for doing art that's fun or entertaining?
Yes, I think so. I guess so. I mean, I'm willing to accept the fact that what I do is low art, as opposed to, you know, high art, which there is a certain thing as high art, I think.
What's the difference between the two?
Well, I use material that is really very common material that really is a kind of in the public domain, and I try to reach a level which is the level I'm on. It's exactly the level I'm on, and I feel some sort of confidence in sort of attaining, I mean, reaching other people that think the same way. But that's a sort of performing. It is a certain kind of, you know, it's entertainment. I think I'm sort of conscious. I like entertainment. And you have to compromise to entertain, I think, as opposed to a new idea, which is maybe a rarefied idea that only a few can grasp initially.
Well, do you feel like your work is a compromise, or does what you really love happen to coincide with what
a
lot of other people love?
Well, it's a compromise in one way, but it isn't in another. I mean, it's not too idiosyncratic. I mean, it's fairly broad. It's broad, and it's, you know, although I think the public can understand a great deal. You know, I think you can put a lot of stuff in, and it comes across okay. But I'm using a common vehicle.
Do you consider yourself to be a social critic at all?
I don't. It's like jokes. I don't try to make jokes either. I wouldn't dare make a joke. But it just, you know, I have, you know, things come out as you work. I don't attempt to do these things. I don't consciously attempt to make satire.
In New York, you did your piece Ruckus, Manhattan, and it's gone through different variations. Would you be able to describe how the idea for the piece first came to you, and what that initial vision was?
Yeah. My wife at the time, Mimi Gross, and I had a long-standing plan to make Manhattan, and that had sort of originated when we made the city of Chicago in 1968 in Chicago at the Allen Frumkin Gallery. And that just idea was just a long time on the shelf. We were thinking about it, and then bicentennial came along, and Creative Time in New York got this big space. I heard they had a great big space downtown. They were going to let me work and use as a studio. And at the same time, Frank Lloyd of Marlboro Gallery had asked me to do a big piece on the city. So all those elements came together. And so we decided to do it. And it really was exactly a year in the works. It started the 1st of May, and the show opened the 1st of May the following year.
One of the really exciting moments of the piece for me, you step into a subway car, and there's sculptures of all your typical subway riders, the bag people and businessmen reading their newspapers, a couple of gang-type youths, all hanging from straps or sitting down, and there's lots of graffiti and like fake advertisements on the subway walls. But the real shock is when you step onto the car, it shakes like a subway car in motion would. And I think one of the things I really thought about throughout that piece was how awful it is to really step on the subway when you're going for a ride in Manhattan, and how much fun it was to do that experience as art, you know, to do that experience in your sculpture. It's funny sometimes how, like, the real experience is so drab and uninspired, but the recreation of it is so exciting.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And one of the cases like that to me was when I did the discount store in Minneapolis. They asked me to come out and do this discount store. They had one in mind. I went out, and I was kind of thinking of John's Bargain Store, like you see in New York. It's very colorful and real crazy with just a lot of color. So I go into the Minneapolis store, and it looks cold, you know, really kind of rigid and cold. So I was crushed. I had to fight that element for the whole time I was working on the piece to try to bring in a kind of fantasy and allegory that I wanted to be there and actually wasn't. It wasn't in what I actually saw. But then in the process of working on, you know, you're working with, you're translating into wood or cloth and so forth, there that change makes almost automatically removes it from the commonplace.
I think it takes a really special vision to be able to see that kind of allegory in the ordinary circumstance that you usually walk through like a sleepwalker. I mean, really, when you go shopping, who's paying attention? Or when you're stepping on the subway, you've got your nose in the newspaper, or you're trying to take a nap until you get to your stop. You're not really looking at the environment, and it's usually not pleasing in any way either to look at.
Yeah, I think art's a marvelous medium in that can transpose things into an extraordinary sort of reality, and it's just a common medium that artists have to work with. And I wasn't really aware of what I was doing with the subway myself. Everybody talked about how it was just like these grotesqueries in the subway, and I started seeing it more that way myself after I'd done it.
Do you consider yourself to be a streetwise person? Like when you're confronted with the kind of street stuff that you put in Ruckus, Manhattan, even like the little porn district that's in there, how do you react?
Well, I'm more streetwise than I was when I first went to New York from Nashville. That's for sure. Because I have lived in Manhattan for 25 years. But, I don't know. I mean, I could still fall into something bad could overcome me at any moment, you know. You do have to keep on your toes. It's true.
When you're walking through the street, though, do you see it through the allegorical vision that you create in your sculpture?
No,
or is
not
it
at
just
all.
Ordinary?
No, I wish I could. Then I could just do the work directly. I have to go through a sort of transforming process. I can't just do my own work straight out. It goes through a sort of process. And it's very peculiar. I mean, why you can't, you know, I guess that would be what you would think, that's the way I see things. And it's really not. It's a process that I have to get to by working on it.
In a lot of your pieces, everybody's really stereotyped, you know, stereotyped as a historical figure or as a businessman or a bag person or a porn person. Has anybody ever accused you of racism because of some of the stereotypes you use in, say, portraying black people?
Yeah, a little bit, not too much. I'm a little sensitive to that because I'm interested in the different races. I think it's kind of marvelous, you know, the races, and of course, you know, I mean, you know, the element of caricature. I mean, it could be offensive to one group or any group you could occasionally be offensive, and I guess that's just one of the hazards of doing this kind of broad farcical stuff. I guess I am susceptible to, you know, overstepping the bounds of good taste occasionally, but my only defense is that, you know, I do want to portray the races. I do want to at least make some feeble attempt to show the vitality of the different kinds of people I see.
Do you feel that showing differences is sometimes just the kind of thing that will bring on the accusation of racism? Is it difficult to show difference?
One piece I'm just about to do that I'm still worried about, I don't know what's going to happen, it's called A Shootout, and it depicts an Indian and a cowboy shooting at each other over a couple of little hills. And I was afraid that it's going to be set up in Denver, Colorado, and I was worried that it might be offensive to the Indian community, or maybe the cowboy community, I don't know, could be. But I don't know, it's the way I wanted to bring up this conflict. I mean, it's a conflict everybody knows about, and I just felt like to make it, you know, kind of a burlesque, concretely a burlesque that everybody could see. I don't know, it just occurred to me to do it. I wanted to do it, and I can't justify these things sometimes. I'd like to be able to, but you just get a vision of things and you do them.
Well, I guess
I'm not always on the right side. I mean, you know, I have my own, you know, point of view, limited point of view, which I have to work out of.
Would you, in a way, try to not think about something too much? Since I imagine a lot of what you do is more intuitive than it is, you know, logical or even intellectual.
Yeah, it's intuitive, all right. But I do listen. I try to listen to people, and, you know, if I get an opinion, I'll try to, you know, you try to rectify, like, undo exaggerations. One thing people misunderstand when I do, I usually am kind of in love with the people I caricature. I think of it more as mannerism than caricature. I'm trying to stress, like, the vitality of personality more than ugliness or, you know, really. I don't really try to stress any ugliness too much, although some of my stuff is ugly, I'll admit that.
No, but I think it's that vitality that makes me, like during Ruckus Manhattan, feel so excited seeing your recreation of the things that can be kind of mundane or even offensive in real life, you know, like the subways, for instance.
Yeah.
Could you do something on your own home, like if you went to Nashville?
Well, I got a great subject there. I mean, the Grand Ole Opry is right there. I'd love to do it. If it wasn't my hometown, I probably would have done it by now. And I have thought of doing it. But it's a little bit more difficult, I think, to work in your hometown.
Yeah, why is that?
Well, my family lives there, you know, and I don't know. Just you know, you feel somehow you're sort of restricted by your own, you know, memories of kind of growing up there. And I still have hopes of doing something on the Grand Ole Opry, though.
What would you want to do with it?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't know what I would do.
Since you've spent time looking and thinking about Philadelphia and are pretty constantly doing that in New York, I guess, what's your impressions of the differences and similarities between the two cities?
Well, I've traveled in Italy, and it always excited me, the idea of the city-states and the cultures that would arise from a city alone. And I think Philadelphia has a very big personality and uniquely different from New York. I think of it a bit like Siena as opposed to New York's Florence, where there's a kind of elegance here as opposed to New York's, you know, bustle.
Do you spend much time in museums?
Sure.
What section do you usually go in? What do you usually look for? What interests you most?
Gosh, just the first things I see when I walk in the door. I'm good for about 15 minutes, and then I start getting tired. But I'm good, you know, I'm fresh on almost anything I see right off the bat.
Do you have artistic inspirations, people whose work you've really sought out and who have influenced you or inspired you?
Sure, I've always loved Aikens.
It's such an interesting comparison because, like, your work is so involved with a caricature and a very personal, mythological interpretation of what's around you, and his seemed to be so much more almost factual, I mean, very realistic.
Yeah, but he's a real spook. I mean, there's a certain haunted quality about everything he does, you know, which really overcomes any, he's in no way, he's not an academic artist at all, I don't think. I mean, his range of subject was so big, and that he created whole new areas of subject matter.
You have in Philadelphia Cornucopia some scholars on the Schuylkill.
Right.
Is that a reference to the real scholars or to Aikens?
No, it's to Aikens, uh-huh. Absolutely. I got all mixed up because I really wanted, I tried to use Aikens as a reference point, but I just had a kind of a reproduction that just wasn't clear enough. I couldn't really tell what the bridges look like behind. When you look at his paintings, you think they are very factual, but when you try to glean some information for yourself, it's hard to tell. So what I did, I took one afternoon, we were working in my studio in New York, and we had to get one of the backgrounds. I had to do the cartoon for the background. I hadn't done it yet. And my assistant, Rolla Herman, said I should go. It was a nice day, and I should come to Philadelphia and draw the river. So I came here and went down by the waterworks and I tried to figure out how I could see the waterworks and the boathouses in the same view. So I had to cross the bridge there, and it's a little difficult because everything's mostly for cars. And then I was able to kind of go off the highway and down near the water's edge on the far side from the waterworks, and I could, from that point, I could see the boathouses and that waterfall and the waterwork, the classical architecture there. But then I was very worried because I knew it was not the part of the river where the sculling could happen because of the waterfall. This is these crazy things that I worry about. But then when I got back to my studio, I realized, you know, the whole thing, there's a whole element of illogicalness about the whole thing anyway, and it really didn't matter if I put these roars beneath the falls. So what I did, I made, instead of the two-man skull, I have, I guess it's a six or an eight-man one in my piece.
Yeah, it is pretty long.
But it all stemmed from those wonderful perspective drawings that Aikens did.
Do you have a lot of art in your home or other kinds of objects that you visually like?
Yeah. I have some art. I sometimes enjoy buying my contemporaries' work, you know. It's been a very exciting season in New York. A lot of young artists coming up now, and I was trying to, some of them I'm trying to buy before they get too expensive, because I've seen so much go by. I've missed out so much that I'm trying to get on the bandwagon now.
Do you collect any objects? Or
I used to collect 10 toys, but I had a big big affair with collecting 10 toys for a while, about 5 years, and I've kind of dropped out of doing that, and now I'm interested more in paintings or prints or sculpture.
What about advertising imagery, since you do that really well, I think, just like the signs that you see on a street when you're walking by?
Well, yeah, when I was collecting the 10 toys, I was interested in advertising imagery, but now I'm just, I don't know, just actual works of art by other people interest me.
Movies?
I like movies.
Big spectacular cast of thousands type movies?
Yeah, well, that's where my aesthetics kind of come from, is because, what I was crazy about as a kid were elaborate productions, film productions, Hollywood productions, and my criteria was how many people were in the scenes, you know, how big a scene it was. It was like spectacle was my criteria of whether it was good or bad.
Which is the best spectacle movie from your youth that you remember?
Well, I loved Samson and Delilah by DeMille, and there was a wonderful picture called The Captain from Castile, was very good, with Tyrone Power. And I can't remember the name. I liked all the Robin Hood pictures. And then the wonderful picture with, I guess, Ingrid Bergman, the Joan of Arc. That was very good. I think that was the Hollywood Joan of Arc.
Is that the one with Gene Seberg?
No, it's before Gene. Gene Seberg, I think, was Otto Preminger.
That's right.
I don't know who did the Ingrid Bergman one, but it was a terrific battle, a terrific siege of a castle. I just generally liked mass crowd scenes.
What are your films like?
Well, it's funny because my films are basically, they're kind of spectacles, but they're homemade. They're homemade spectacles, and you're supposed to be able to tell that. They're supposed to look like they were made in Albania or something like that.
How do you achieve that effect?
It's just the way I naturally do it. I don't know. It's the way I think about solving the problems for technical problems.
Do you use your art as the set for it?
Yeah, I do the sets and the costumes. And, of course, that's my real reason for doing them in the first place.
So you can get your art a starring role?
Yeah. Because I basically look at movies or visually, you know, I'm interested more than literarily.
You work with a lot of art students or people who've recently graduated from art schools. Do you ever like compare your art training with their art training?
Well, I learn a lot from the people I work with, and when I was working on Ruckus Manhattan, the tendency was that everyone painted very flatly, and my kind of coming out period was during the abstract expressionist heyday. So my tendency is to be rather floral in my painting style, you know, sort of over painterly. And their tendency was to be quite flat. So if I would have something, a surface paint, it would turn out to be beautifully flat. And I wanted it to be a little bit lumpy bumpy.
How would you get around that?
But it helped me that I kind of gave me a little bit more awareness of a kind of a more control, especially over color. I was more like a palette painter, you know. I just get a bunch of colors on my palette and start smushing them around and putting them on and not really maintaining an overall scheme of color. And I would paint with people, especially women. I think women have a very acute sense of color, naturally. Very, very aware of all exactly what colors go down. And I was more looser.
Well, you were kind of an outcast amongst abstract expressionists, weren't you?
I like abstract expressionism. I liked it when I was, you know, in my early 20s, and it was the work that excited me in the first place to, you know, start painting. But But going on now, I was just doing a piece in Cleveland working with the art students there, and they painted like I used to paint. I mean, I think the style back now is to kind of really painterly painting and like a lot of brushwork, a lot of freedom of brushwork, if not really sloppiness, at least a lot of looseness in the handling.
Do you find the students today approach art with a different conceptual framework?
I think they're better prepared than I was. I think the art schools have gotten better. Or either that or I wasn't hip to where to go. I don't know why.
What makes you think they've gotten better?
I just think they're better. I think in the last, you know, I went to school in 55, and I was a lousy student. I didn't really know how to learn anyway, except my way I learned was just looking at other work. But to be, you know, like to be instructed, I was not too keen on. But I have done guest studio visits and stuff. And I think the general subtle preparation for a professional art career is much higher, because the teachers are professional artists.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why they're spread throughout the country. You know, there's a big spread of professionals that have gone into the graduate programs, and so I think it's a known fact that they're turning out a great deal of would-be artists.
In the 60s, you became known for the happenings that you did. Would that kind of performance work today, do you think?
Well... No, because I remember once seeing a Dubuffet performance at the Guggenheim, and it was kind of marvelous, very elaborate, and they had done everything to the teeth. But my feeling was that they missed the boat. If it had been done 10 years before, it would have been terrific. But there was something digested about it, and I think that. Well, if I did them now, I'd have to get with it. You can't show pre-digested stuff.
Would you describe one of your pieces from the 60s?
Yeah, actually, they were from the late 50s. I only did, I think, three works, and they were done in the span of about 4 months. My first one, called The Walking Man, I did in Provincetown, Massachusetts, in a small gallery, the Sun Gallery there. And they were very immediate. My idea really was that I wanted to get into showbiz, but I didn't have any talents. I couldn't sing, dance, or anything else. So the only thing I could do was kind of do the scenic work, you know, make the props and some kind of a background. But my thought was, well, okay, if it's allowed in collage to use anything you want, why can't I just put some people in here and have them go through a sort of a routine? And that's what I did. And in order not to get too literary, I was afraid I would get too literary. I wanted to get literary, but I didn't have any talent at it. I kept the pieces real short. They were only like 10, 12, 15 minutes at absolute most. So what you were seeing was kind of like a moving picture. I mean, a picture with real participants in it. But there was a sort of literary structure in there somewhere. There's always a little bit of literature in my work, I think.
So what would happen during the course of one of those pieces?
Well, sort of mayhem. I mean, there was a lot of... There were some quiet moments, but basically I wanted to be a little hocus-pocus. I didn't want to give away too much. That was a very existentialist time, and I was into kind of a mystery thing. There would be a little bit of reading of some prepared text by me, but not very much, very short. And then we would use signals somewhat like football signals to kind of cue the action. And there would just be a sequence of kind of moving through the props, using the props, and getting eventually to a kind of quick ending, and that'd be it.
You still have any interest in show business?
Oh, yeah. Well, I consider the Philadelphia Cornucopia show business.
You want to explain that?
Well, I feel like it's a kind of, I think it's a bit more, you know, it's more heightened than, say, a show of mine would be if it was... A show of work that I do that was not thematic and was not attempting at an overall impact of scale and so forth, and that there is a sort of overall literary effect in there that kind of hangs it together in the space, in the sculptural space. So I kind of think I'm as sculptural novels or as kind of... static theater, somewhat kin to dioramas and shows of those kind.
when you were in grade school, did you have to make dioramas?
Yes.
Out of shoe boxes with cellophane over them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. the one thing I did that was really akin to that, that was is more close to what I do now, is I made a big carnival. I made a kind of a model carnival, and I was really into that.
You have been quoted as saying, "I am like a comedian who wants to do serious roles." Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, well, that was last year. No, I want to. Yeah, I like to do watercolors, for instance, just straight watercolors, real straight. And that's what I'm. I guess that's what I mean. I always think of Jerry Lewis as somebody that always has this kind of normal personality, and you really don't want to see it. You want him just to be a nut all the time. And I guess everybody wants to be taken seriously. But right now I don't feel too concerned about that, because I've had a big year. I worked on setting Ruckus Manhattan up, and I worked on the Cornucopia, so those were big, very big sculptural pieces. And
things that are funny can be taken seriously, can't they? Or, you know, reckoned with as seriously as serious things.
I guess there is a difference. I guess there's somewhere a basic difference between seriousness and funniness.
Do you think that they both ultimately matter as much to someone who gets a lot from each kind of piece?
I don't know. That I don't know. I'm not sure. I really don't know. I know there's a great deal of illusion in it. I think that in making a work that it's funny, it's just as serious as making a serious piece, because what you're trying to do is just sustain a sort of an effect. You know, you're really just trying to make a sustained effect. So it's not really, people think it's fun. I hate to disillusion them. It is kind of fun, but I don't know if it'd be any more fun than making a serious piece.
Do you know what your next big piece is going to be?
Well, it'll be this piece for Denver called The Shootout, which is an aluminum, fabricated aluminum, and some elements of it are cast. And we're trying to get that ready for next fall.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Tara.